Thank you, errors. Now we get into errors and how the errors of some people carry benefits for others. We can simplify the relationships between fragility, errors, and anti-fragility as follows. When you are fragile, you depend on things following the exact planned course, with as little deviation as possible, for deviations are more harmful than helpful. This is why the fragile needs to be very predictive in its approach, and, conversely, predictive systems cause fragility. When you want deviations and you don't care about the possible dispersion of outcomes that the future can bring, since most will be helpful, you are anti-fragile. Further, the random element in trial and error is not quite random if it is carried out rationally, using error as a source of information. If every trial provides you with information about what does not work, you start zooming in on a solution. So every attempt becomes more valuable, more like an expense than an error. And of course, you make discoveries along the way. Learning from the mistakes of others. But recall that this chapter is about layering, units, hierarchies, fractal structure, and the difference between the interest of a unit and those of its subunits. So it is often the mistakes of others that benefit the rest of us, and, sadly, not them. We saw that stressors are information, in the right context. For the anti-fragile, harm from errors should be less than the benefits. We are talking about some, not all, errors, of course. Those that do not destroy a system help prevent larger calamities. The engineer and historian of engineering, Henry Petrosky, presents a very elegant point. Had the Titanic not had that famous accident, as fatal as it was, we would have kept building larger and larger ocean liners, and the next disaster would have been even more tragic. So the people who perished were sacrificed for the greater good. They unarguably saved more lives than were lost. The story of the Titanic illustrates the difference between gains for the system and harm to some of its individual parts. The same can be said of the debacle of Fukushima. One can safely say that it made us aware of the problem with nuclear reactors and small probabilities, and prevented larger catastrophes. Note that the errors of naive stress testing and reliance on risk models were quite obvious at the time. As with the economic crisis, nobody wanted to listen. Every plane crash brings us closer to safety, improves the system, and makes the next flight safer. Those who perish contribute to the overall safety of others. Swiss Flight 111, TWA Flight 800, and Air France Flight 447 allowed the improvement of the system. But these systems learn because they are anti-fragile and set up to exploit small errors. The same cannot be said of economic crashes, since the economic system is not anti-fragile the way it is presently built. Why? There are hundreds of thousands of plane flights every year, and a crash in one plane does not involve others, so errors remain confined and highly epistemic. Whereas globalized economic systems operate as one, errors spread and compound. Again, crucially, we are talking of partial, not general, mistakes, small, not severe and terminal ones. This creates a separation between good and bad systems. Good systems, such as airlines, are set up to have small errors, independent from each other, or, in effect, negatively correlated to each other, since mistakes lower the odds of future mistakes. This is one way to see how one environment can be anti-fragile, aviation, and the other fragile, modern economic life with Earth is flat-style interconnectedness. If every plane crash makes the next one less likely, every bank crash makes the next one more likely. We need to eliminate the second type of error, the one that produces contagion in our construction of an ideal socioeconomic system. Let us examine Mother Nature once again. The natural was built from non-systemic mistake to non-systemic mistake. My errors lifting stones, when I am well calibrated, translate into small injuries that guide me the next time, as I try to avoid pain. After all, that's the purpose of pain. Leopards, who move like a true symphony of nature, are not instructed by personal trainers on the proper form to lift a deer up a tree. Human advice might work with artificial sports like, say, tennis, bowling, or gun shooting, not with natural movements. Some businesses love their own mistakes. Reinsurance companies who focus on insuring catastrophic risks and are used by insurance companies to reinsure such non-diversifiable risks manage to do well after a calamity or tail event that causes them to take a hit. If they are still in business and have their powder dry, few manage to have plans for such contingency, they make it up by disproportionately raising premia. Customers overreact and pay up for insurance. They claim to have no idea about fair value, that is, proper pricing for reinsurance, but they certainly know that it is overpriced at times of stress, which is sufficient to them to make a long-term shekel. All they need is to keep their mistakes small enough so they can survive them. How to become Mother Teresa. Variability causes mistakes and adaptations. It also allows you to know who your friends are. Both your failures and your successes will give you information. But, and this is one of the good things in life, sometimes you only know about someone's character after you harm them with an error for which you are solely responsible. I have been astonished at the generosity of some persons in the way they forgave me for my mistakes. And of course you learn from the errors of others. You may never know what type of person someone is unless they are given opportunities to violate moral or ethical codes. I remember a classmate, a girl in high school, who seemed nice and honest and part of my childhood group of anti-materialistic utopists. I learned that against my expectations and her innocent looks, she didn't turn out to become Mother Teresa or Rosa Luxemburg, as she dumped her first rich husband for another richer person, whom she dumped upon his first financial difficulties for yet another richer and more powerful and generous lover. In a non-volatile environment, I, and most probably she too, would have mistaken her for a utopist and a saint. Some members of society, those who did not marry her, got valuable information, while others, her victims, paid the price. Further, my characterization of a loser is someone who, after making a mistake, doesn't introspect, doesn't exploit it, feels embarrassed and defensive rather than enriched with a new piece of information, and tries to explain why he made the mistake rather than moving on. These types often consider themselves the victims of some large plot, a bad boss, or bad weather. Finally, a thought. He who has never sinned is less reliable than he who has only sinned once. And someone who has made plenty of errors, though never the same error more than once, is more reliable than someone who has never made any. Why the aggregate hates the individual. We saw that antifragility in biology works thanks to layers. This rivalry between suborganisms contributes to evolution. Cells within our bodies compete. Within the cells, proteins compete, all the way through. Let us translate the point into human endeavors. The economy has an equivalent layering. Individuals, artisans, small firms, departments within corporations, corporations, industries, the regional economy, and finally, on top, the general economy. One can even have thinner slicing with a larger number of layers. For the economy to be anti-fragile and undergo what is called evolution, every single individual business must necessarily be fragile, exposed to breaking. Evolution needs organisms, or their genes, to die when supplanted by others, in order to achieve improvement, or to avoid reproduction when they are not as fit as someone else. Accordingly, the anti-fragility of the higher level may require the fragility and sacrifice of the lower one. Every time you use a coffee maker for your morning cappuccino, you are benefiting from the fragility of the coffee-making entrepreneur who failed. He failed in order to help put the superior merchandise on your kitchen counter. Also, consider traditional societies. There, too, we have a similar layering. Individuals, immediate families, extended families, tribes, people using the same dialects, ethnicities, groups. While sacrifice as a modus is obvious in the case of ant colonies, I am certain that individual businessmen are not overly interested in harakiri for the greater good of the economy. They are therefore necessarily concerned in seeking anti-fragility, or at least some level of robustness for themselves. That's not necessarily compatible with the interest of the collective, that is, the economy. So there is a problem in which the property of the sum, the aggregate, varies from that of each one of the parts. In fact, it wants harm to the parts. It is painful to think about ruthlessness as an engine of improvement. Now, what is the solution? There is none, alas, that can please everyone, but there are ways to mitigate the harm to the very weak. The problem is graver than you think. People go to business school to learn how to do well while ensuring their survival, but what the economy, as a collective, wants them to do is to not survive, rather to take a lot of imprudent risks themselves and be blinded by the odds. Their respective industries improve from failure to failure. Natural and nature-like systems want some overconfidence on the part of individual economic agents, that is, the overestimation of their chances of success and underestimation of the risks of failure in their businesses, provided their failure does not impact others. In other words, they want local but not global overconfidence. We saw that the restaurant business is wonderfully efficient precisely because restaurants, being vulnerable, go bankrupt every minute, and entrepreneurs ignore such a possibility as they think that they will beat the odds. In other words, some class of rash, even suicidal, risk-taking is healthy for the economy, under the condition that not all people take the same risks and that these risks remain small and localized. Now, by disrupting the model, as we will see, with bailouts, governments typically favor a certain class of firms that are large enough to require being saved in order to avoid contagion to other business. This is the opposite of healthy risk-taking. It is transferring fragility from the collective to the unfit. People have difficulty realizing that the solution is building a system in which nobody's fall can drag others down, for continuous failures work to preserve the system. Paradoxically, many government interventions and social policies end up hurting the weak and consolidating the established. What does not kill me kills others. Time to debunk a myth. As an advocate of anti-fragility, I need to warn about illusions of seeing it when it is not really there. We can mistake the anti-fragility of the system for that of the individual, when in fact it takes place at the expense of the individual, the difference between hormesis and selection. Nietzsche's famous expression, "What does not kill me makes me stronger," can be easily misinterpreted as meaning mithridatization or hormesis. It may be one of these two phenomena, very possible, but it could as well mean, "What did not kill me did not make me stronger, but spared me because I am stronger than others. But it killed others, and the average population is now stronger because the weak are gone." In other words, I passed an exit exam. I've discussed the problem in earlier writings of the false illusion of causality, with a newspaper article saying that the new mafia members, former Soviet exiles, had been hardened by a visit to the Gulag, the Soviet concentration camps. Since the sojourn in the Gulag killed the weakest, one had the illusion of strengthening. Sometimes we see people having survived trials and imagine, given that the surviving population is sturdier than the original one, that these trials are good for them. In other words, the trial can just be a ruthless exam that kills those who fail. All we may be witnessing is that transfer of fragility, rather anti-fragility, from the individual to the system that I discussed earlier. Let me present it in a different way. The surviving cohort, clearly, is stronger than the initial one, but not quite the individuals, since the weaker ones died. Someone paid a price for the system to improve. Me and us. This visible tension between individual and collective interests is new in history. In the past, it was dealt with by the near irrelevance of individuals. Sacrifice for the sake of the group is behind the notion of heroism. It is good for the tribe, bad for those who perish under the fever of war. This instinct for heroism and the fading of individual interests in favor of the communal has become aberrant with suicide bombers. These pre-death terrorists get into a mood similar to an ecstatic trance in which their emotions drive them to become indifferent to their own mortality. It is a fallacy that suicide bombers are driven by the promise of a reward, of some Islamic paradise with virgins and other entertainment. For, as the anthropologist Scott Atran has pointed out, the first suicide bombers in the Levant were revolutionaries of Greek Orthodox background. My tribe, not Islamists. There is something like a switch in us that kills the individual in favor of the collective when people engage in communal dances, mass riots, or war. Your mood is now that of the herd. You are part of what Elias Canetti calls the rhythmic and throbbing crowd. You can also feel a different variety of crowd experience during your next street riot, when fear of authorities vanishes completely under group fever. Let us now generalize the point. Looking at the world from a certain distance, I see a total tension between man and nature, a tension in the trade-off of fragilities. We saw how nature wants herself, the aggregate, to survive, not every species, just as, in turn, every single species wants its individuals to be fragile, particularly after reproduction, for evolutionary selection to take place. We saw how such transfer of fragility from individuals to species is necessary for its overall survival. Species are potentially anti-fragile, given that DNA is information, but members of the species are perishable, hence ready to sacrifice and in reality designed to do so for the benefit of the collective. Anti-fragility, smanti-fragility. Some of the ideas about fitness and selection here are not very comfortable to this author, which makes the writing of some sections rather painful. I detest the ruthlessness of selection, the inexorable disloyalty of Mother Nature. I detest the notion of improvement thanks to harm to others. As a humanist, I stand against the anti-fragility of systems at the expense of individuals, for if you follow the reasoning, this makes us humans individually irrelevant. The great benefit of the Enlightenment has been to bring the individual to the fore, with his rights, his freedom, his independence, his pursuit of happiness, whatever that happiness means, and, most of all, his privacy. In spite of its denial of anti-fragility, the Enlightenment and the political systems that emerged from it freed us, somewhat, from the domination of society, the tribe, and the family that had prevailed throughout history. The unit in traditional cultures is the collective, and it could be perceived to be harmed by the behavior of an individual. The honor of the family is sullied when, say, a daughter becomes pregnant, or a member of the family engages in large-scale financial swindles and Ponzi schemes, or, worst, may even teach a college course in the charlatanic subject of financial economics. And these mores persist. Even as recently as the late 19th century or early 20th, it was common in, say, rural France, for someone to spend all his savings to erase the debts of a remote cousin, a practice called passer l'éponge, literally, to use a sponge to erase the liability from the chalkboard, and to do so in order to preserve the dignity and good name of the extended family. It was perceived as a duty. I confess having done some of that myself in the 21st century. Clearly, the system needs to be there for the individual to survive, so one needs to be careful in glorifying one interest against others in the presence of interdependence and complexity. Many people think at first that their own death is the worst black swan scenario. It is not. Unless they've studied too much modern economics, they would agree explicitly that their death plus the death of their loved ones plus the termination of humanity would be a vastly worse outcome than their own death. Recall my comment on complex systems. We are a mere part of a large chain, and we are worried about both ourselves and the system, as well as the preservation of parts of that large chain. In the Cosa Nostra, the Sicilian Mafia, the designation man of honor, uomo d'onore, implies that the person caught by the police would remain silent and not rat on his friends, regardless of benefits, and that life in prison is preferable to a plea that entails hurting other members. The tribe, Cosa Nostra, comes before the individual. And what broke the back of the Mafia was the recent generation of plea bargainers. Note that honor in the Mafia is limited to such in-group solidarity. They otherwise lie, and there is nothing honorable about them in other domains. And they kill people from behind, something that on the east side of the Mediterranean is considered the purest form of cowardice. Likewise, we humans may have to be self-centered at the expense of other species, at the risk of ecological fragility, if it ensures our survival. Our interests as a human race prevail over those of nature, and we can tolerate some inefficiency, some fragility, in order to protect individuals, although sacrificing nature too much may eventually hurt ourselves. We saw the trade-off between the interests of the collective and those of the individual. An economy cannot survive without breaking individual eggs. Protection is harmful, and constraining the forces of evolution to benefit individuals does not seem required. But we can shield individuals from starvation, provide some social protection, and give them respect. Or more, as we see next. National Entrepreneur Day. Meanwhile, if as a utopist, indeed, I hate what I am figuring out, I think that there is hope. Heroism and the respect it commands is a form of compensation by society for those who take risks for others, and entrepreneurship is a risky and heroic activity, necessary for growth or even the mere survival of the economy. It is also necessarily collective on epistemological grounds to facilitate the development of expertise. Someone who did not find something is providing others with knowledge, the best knowledge, that of absence, what does not work. Yet he gets little or no credit for it. He is a central part of the process with incentives going to others and, what is worse, gets no respect. A correspondent, Jean-Louis Roll, wrote, "I have noticed that the more people glorify the entrepreneur as an abstraction, the more they will scorn an actual one they meet." I am an ingrate toward the man whose overconfidence caused him to open a restaurant and fail, enjoying my nice meal while he is probably eating canned tuna. In order to progress, modern society should be treating ruined entrepreneurs in the same way we honor dead soldiers, perhaps not with as much honor, but using exactly the same logic. The entrepreneur is still alive, though perhaps morally broken and socially stigmatized, particularly if he lives in Japan. For there is no such thing as a failed soldier, dead or alive, unless he acted in a cowardly manner. Likewise, there is no such thing as a failed entrepreneur or failed scientific researcher, any more than there is a successful babbler, philosopher, commentator, consultant, lobbyist, or business school professor who does not take personal risks. Sorry. Psychologists label overconfidence a disease, blinding people to the odds of success when engaging in ventures. But there is a difference between the benign, heroic type of risk-taking that is beneficial to others, in the anti-fragile case, and the nastier modern type related to negative black swans, such as the overconfidence of scientists computing the risks of harm from the Fukushima reactor. In the case of the former, what they call overconfidence is a good thing, not something to medicate. And compare entrepreneurs to the bean-counting managers of companies who climb the ladder of hierarchy with hardly ever any real downside. Their cohort is rarely at risk. What Erasmus called ingratitudo vulgi, the ingratitude of the masses, is increasing in the age of globalization and the Internet. My dream, the solution, is that we would have a National Entrepreneur Day with the following message. Most of you will fail. Disrespected, impoverished. But we are grateful for the risks you are taking and the sacrifices you are making for the sake of the economic growth of the planet and pulling others out of poverty. You are at the source of our anti-fragility. Our nation thanks you. Book 2. Modernity and the Denial of Anti-Fragility. As in Baudelaire's sad poem about the albatross, what is made to fly will not do well trapped on the ground, where it is forced to traipse. And it is quite fitting that volatility comes from volare, to fly, in Latin. Depriving political and other systems of volatility harms them, causing eventually greater volatility of the cascading type. This section, Book 2, deals with the fragility that comes from the denial of hormesis, the natural anti-fragility of organisms, and how we hurt systems with the very best of intentions by playing conductor. We are fragilizing social and economic systems by denying them stressors and randomness, putting them in the Procrustean bed of cushy and comfortable, but ultimately harmful, modernity. Procrustes was an innkeeper in Greek mythology who, in order to make the travelers fit in his bed, cut the limbs of those who were too tall and stretched those who were too short. But he had the bed fitting the visitor with total perfection. As we saw in Chapter 3, treating an organism like a simple machine is a kind of simplification or approximation or reduction that is exactly like a Procrustean bed. It is often with the most noble intentions that we do so, as we are pressured to fix things, so we often blow them up with our fear of randomness and love of smoothness. Where simplifications fail, causing the most damage, is when something non-linear is simplified with the linear as a substitute. That is the most common Procrustean bed. Book 2 will also discuss the competition between man and natural forces, the craving of volatility by some anti-fragile systems, and how we make social, political, and other systems vulnerable to black swans when we overstabilize them. Chapter 5. Two different randomness categories seen through the profiles of two brothers. How Switzerland is not controlled from above. The difference between Mediocristan and Extremistan. The virtues of city-states, bottom-up political systems, and the stabilizing effect of municipal noise. The souk and the office building. The reds and the whites all go to Zurich. War is not a prison. The turkeys thwarted projects. Remember, we are in Extremistan. Two types of professions. Consider the fate of Ioannis, John, and Georgios, George, two identical twin brothers, born in Cyprus, both of them, currently both living in the Greater London area. John has been employed for 25 years as a clerk in the personnel department of a large bank, dealing with the relocation of employees around the globe. George is a taxi driver. John has a perfectly predictable income, or so he thinks, with benefits, 4 weeks annual vacation, and a gold watch every 25 years of employment. Every month, £3,082 is deposited in his local NatWest checking account. He spends a portion of it for the mortgage on his house west of London, the utilities, and feta cheese, and has a bit left for his savings. He used to wake up on Saturday morning, the day when people stretch and linger in bed, anxiety-free, telling himself, "Life is good." Until the banking crisis, when he realized that his job could be made redundant. Unemployment would seriously hit him hard. As a personnel expert, he has seen the implosions of long careers with persons who, laid off at the age of 50, never recovered. George, who lives on the same street as his brother, drives a black taxi, meaning he has a license for which he spent 3 years expanding his frontal lobes by memorizing streets and itineraries in Greater London, which gives him the right to pick up clients in the streets. His income is extremely variable. Some days are good. He earns several hundred pounds. Some are worse, when he does not even cover his costs. But, year after year, he averages about the same as his brother. To date, he has only had a single day in his 25-year career without a fare. Because of the variability of his income, he keeps moaning that he does not have the job security of his brother. But in fact, this is an illusion, for he has a bit more. This is the central illusion in life, that randomness is risky, that it is a bad thing, and that eliminating randomness is done by eliminating randomness. Artisans, say taxi drivers, prostitutes, a very, very old profession, carpenters, plumbers, tailors, and dentists have some volatility in their income, but they are rather robust to a minor professional black swan, one that would bring their income to a complete halt. Their risks are visible. Not so with employees, who have no volatility, but can be surprised to see their income going to zero after a phone call from the personnel department. Employees' risks are hidden. Thanks to variability, these artisanal careers harbor a bit of anti-fragility. Small variations make them adapt and change continuously by learning from the environment and being, sort of, continuously under pressure to be fit. Remember that stressors are information. These careers face a continuous supply of these stressors that make them adjust opportunistically. In addition, they are open to gifts and positive surprises, free options, the hallmark of anti-fragility, as we will see in Book 4. George was used to having, once in a while, a crazy request, one he was free to decline. During the Icelandic volcano scare, when UK air traffic was shut down, he was asked by a rich old lady to drive her to a wedding in the south of France, a 2,000-mile round-trip journey. Likewise, a prostitute faces the small probability of seeing a severely infatuated rich client give her a very expensive diamond, or even an offer of matrimony, in what can be expected to be a short transitional period before her widowhood. And George has the freedom to continue until he drops. Many people continue to drive cabs into their 80s, mostly to kill time, since he is his own boss, compared to his brother, who is completely unhirable in his 50s. The difference between the two volatilities in income applies to political systems and, as we will see in the next two chapters, to about everything in life. Man-made smoothing of randomness produces the equivalent of John's income, smooth, steady, but fragile. Such income is more vulnerable to large shocks that can make it go to zero, plus some unemployment benefits if he resides in one of the few welfare states. Natural randomness presents itself more like George's income, smaller role for very large shocks, but daily variability. Further, such variability helps improve the system, hence the anti-fragility. A week with declining earnings for a taxi driver or a prostitute provides information concerning the environment and intimates the need to find a new part of town where clients hang around. A month or so without earnings drives them to revise their skills. Further, for a self-employed person, a small, non-terminal mistake is information, valuable information, one that directs him in his adaptive approach. For someone employed like John, a mistake is something that goes into his permanent record, filed in the personnel department. Yogi Berra once said, "We made the wrong mistake." And for John, all mistakes are wrong mistakes. Nature loves small errors, without which genetic variations are impossible. Humans don't. Hence, when you rely on human judgment, you are at the mercy of a mental bias that disfavors anti-fragility. So, alas, we humans are afraid of the second type of variability and naively fragilize systems, or prevent their antifragility by protecting them. In other words, a point worth repeating every time it applies, this avoidance of small mistakes makes the large ones more severe. The centralized state resembles the income of John, the city-state model that of George. John has one large employer, George many small ones, so he can select the ones that fit him the best and hence has, at any point in time, more options. One has the illusion of stability, but is fragile. The other one, the illusion of variability, but is robust and even anti-fragile. The more variability you observe in a system, the less black swan-prone it is. Let us now examine how this applies to political systems with the story of Switzerland. Lenin in Zurich. I was recently in a cafe-turned-expensive restaurant in Zurich, poring over the overpriced menu, with prices at least triple of those in a place of equivalent quality in the United States. The world's recent crisis had made Switzerland even more of a safe haven than it had ever been, causing its currency to rise dramatically. Switzerland is the most anti-fragile place on the planet. It benefits from shocks that take place in the rest of the world. A friend, a writer, pointed out to me that Lenin, who lived in town, used to play chess in the cafe with a Dadaist poet Tristan Tzara. Yes, the Russian revolutionary Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov, later known as Lenin, spent some time in Switzerland concocting his project of the great top-down modernistic state and largest human experiment in centralized state control. It hit me that there was something eerie in Lenin's presence there. For, a few days before, I had been at a conference in Montreux on Lake Geneva that took place in the same lakefront hotel where Vladimir Nabokov, the emigre Russian aristocrat and victim of Lenin, spent the last couple of decades of his life. It seemed interesting to me that sheltering the Reds and the Whites, both the Bolsheviks and the aristocratic White Russians they later displaced, seems to be part of the primary business of the Helvetic Confederation. The main cities, such as Zurich, Geneva, or Lausanne, bear traces of the political refugees who went there for shelter, emigres, from the Iranian royals thrown out by the Islamists to the latest African potentate executing Plan B. Even Voltaire spent some time hiding in the place, in Ferney, a suburb of Geneva near the French border, before it even joined the Confederation. Voltaire, the perfectly protected gadfly, would rush to Ferney after insulting the King of France, the Catholic Church, or some other authority. What people don't usually know about him is that he also had an incentive to seek protection there for financial reasons. Voltaire was a self-made man, a wealthy merchant, investor, and speculative dealer. It is worth noting that much of his wealth came from the anti-fragility of stressors, as he started building his fortune during his early exile. So, like Voltaire, there are refugees of other types, financial refugees coming from places of turmoil, recognizable by their expensive and boring clothes, bland vocabulary, contrived decorum, and expensive, shiny watches. In other words, non-Voltaires. Like many rich people, they feel entitled to laugh at their own jokes. These dull people are not looking for personal shelter. It is their assets that are seeking refuge. While some political persons might prefer to hide from the risks of their national regime in France or England, more exciting places on Saturday night, it is most certainly in Switzerland that their checking account wants to be. It is economically the most robust place on the planet, and it has been so for quite a few centuries. This great variety of people and their wallets are there, in Switzerland, for its shelter, safety, and stability. But all these refugees don't notice the obvious. The most stable country in the world does not have a government. And it is not stable in spite of not having a government. It is stable because it does not have one. Ask random Swiss citizens to name their president and count the proportion of people who can do so. They can usually name the presidents of France or the United States, but not their own. Its currency works best. At the time of writing, it proved to be the safest, yet its central bank is tiny, even relative to its size. Do these politicians biding their time before, they hope, returning to power notice such absence of government, accept that they are in Switzerland because of such absence of government, and adapt their ideas on nation-states and political systems accordingly? Not at all. It is not quite true that the Swiss do not have a government. What they do not have is a large central government, or what the common discourse describes as the government. What governs them is entirely bottom-up, municipal of sorts, regional entities called cantons, near-sovereign mini-states united in a confederation. There is plenty of volatility, with enmities between residents that stay at the level of fights over water fountains or other such uninspiring debates. This is not necessarily pleasant, since neighbors are transformed into busybodies. This is a dictatorship from the bottom, not from the top, but a dictatorship nonetheless. But this bottom-up form of dictatorship provides protection against the romanticism of utopias, to understand that the process is highly unintellectual, devoid of any sense of the grandiose, even downright puny. There is a famous quip about how the greatest accomplishment of the Swiss was inventing the cuckoo clock, while other nations produced great works. Nice story, except that the Swiss did not invent the cuckoo clock. But the system produces stability, boring stability, at every possible level. Also note that the hideously glitzy scenes one encounters in Switzerland, in all of Geneva, in some parts of Zurich, the center, and particularly in the ski resorts such as Gstaad and St. Moritz, are not the direct product of the country, nor part of its mission, but the result of its success, as Switzerland acts as a magnet for the ugly rich and tax refugees. Note for now that this is the last major country that is not a nation-state, but rather a collection of small municipalities left to their own devices. Bottom-up variations. What I call bottom-up variations, or noise, is the type of political volatility that takes place within a municipality, the petty fights and frictions in the running of regular affairs. It is not scalable, or what is called invariant under scale transformation. In other words, if you increase the size, say, multiply the number of people in a community by 100, you will have markedly different dynamics. A large state does not behave at all like a gigantic municipality, much as a baby human does not resemble a smaller adult. The difference is qualitative. The increase in the number of persons in a given community alters the quality of the relationship between parties. Recall the nonlinearity description from the prologue. If you multiply by 10 the number of persons in a given entity, you do not preserve the properties. There is a transformation. Here, conversations switch from the mundane but effective to abstract numbers. More interesting, more academic perhaps, but, alas, less effective. A cluster of municipalities with charming provincial enmities, their own internal fights, and people out to get one another aggregates to a quite benign and stable state. Switzerland is similar to the income of the second brother, stable because of the variations in noise at the local level. Just as the income of the cab driver shows instability on a daily basis, but annual stability, likewise Switzerland shows stability at the aggregate level, as the ensemble of cantons produces a solid system. The way people handle local affairs is vastly different from the way they handle large, abstract public expenditures. We have traditionally lived in small units and tribes and managed rather well in small units. Further, biology plays a role in a municipal environment, not in a larger system. An administration is shielded from having to feel the sting of shame, with flushing in his face, a biological reaction to overspending and other failures, such as killing people in Vietnam. Eye contact with one's peers changes one's behavior. But for a desk-grounded office leech, a number is just a number. Someone you see in church Sunday morning would feel uncomfortable for his mistakes and more responsible for them. On the small, local scale, his body and biological response would direct him to avoid causing harm to others. On a large scale, others are abstract items. Given the lack of social contact with the people concerned, the civil servant's brain leads rather than his emotions, with numbers, spreadsheets, statistics, more spreadsheets, and theories. When I expressed this idea to my co-author, Mark Blythe, he blurted out the obvious. Stalin could not have existed in a municipality. Small is beautiful in so many other ways. Take for now that the small, in the aggregate that is, a collection of small units, is more anti-fragile than the large. In fact, the large is doomed to breaking, a mathematical property we will explain later that sadly seems universal as it applies to large corporations, very large mammals, and large administrations. It is quite distressing to hear debates about political systems that make comparisons between countries when the size of the entities is not the same. Say, comparing Singapore to Malaysia. The size of the unit may matter more than the system. There is another issue with the abstract state, a psychological one. We humans scorn what is not concrete. We are more easily swayed by a crying baby than by thousands of people dying elsewhere that do not make it to our living room through the TV set. The one case is a tragedy, the other a statistic. Our emotional energy is blind to probability. The media make things worse as they play on our infatuation with anecdotes, our thirst for the sensational, and they cause a great deal of unfairness that way. At the present time, one person is dying of diabetes every 7 seconds, but the news can only talk about victims of hurricanes with houses flying in the air. The problem is that by creating bureaucracies, we put civil servants in a position to make decisions based on abstract and theoretical matters, with the illusion that they will be making them in a rational, accountable way. Also consider that lobbyists, this annoying race of lobbyists, cannot exist in a municipality or small region. The Europeans, thanks to the centralization of some power with the European Commission in Brussels, are quickly discovering the existence of these mutants coming to manipulate democracy for the sake of some large corporation. By influencing one single decision or regulation in Brussels, a single lobbyist gets a large bang. It is a much larger payoff at low cost than with municipalities, which would require armies of lobbyists trying to convince people while embedded in their communities. Thankfully, the European Union is legally protected from over-centralization thanks to the principle of subsidiarity. Things should be handled by the smallest possible unit that can manage them with efficacy. The idea was inherited from the Catholic Church. Philosophically, a unit doesn't need to be very large, the state, nor very small, the individual, but somewhere in between. This is a powerful philosophical statement, particularly in light of both the transfers of fragility we saw in Chapter 4 and the notion that size fragilizes, much on which later. Consider, too, the other effect of scale. Small corporations are less likely to have lobbyists. The same bottom-up effect applies to law. The Italian political and legal philosopher Bruno Leone has argued in favor of the robustness of judge-based law, owing to its diversity, as compared to explicit and rigid codifications. True, the choice of a court could be a lottery, but it helps prevent large-scale mistakes. I use the example of Switzerland to show the natural anti-fragility of political systems and how stability is achieved by managing noise, having a mechanism for letting it run its natural course, not by minimizing it. Note another element of Switzerland. It is perhaps the most successful country in history, yet it has traditionally had a very low level of university education compared to the rest of the rich nations. Its system, even in banking during my days, was based on apprenticeship models, nearly vocational rather than theoretical ones. In other words, on techne, crafts and know-how, not episteme, book knowledge, know-what. Away from extremistan. Let us now examine the technical aspects of the process, a more statistical view of the effect of human intervention on the volatility of affairs. There is a certain mathematical property to this bottom-up volatility, and to the volatility of natural systems. It generates the kind of randomness I call mediocristan, plenty of variations that might be scary but tend to cancel out in the aggregate, over time or over the collection of municipalities that constitute the larger confederation or entity, rather than the unruly one called extremistan, in which you have mostly stability and occasionally large chaos. Errors there have large consequences. One fluctuates, the other jumps. One has a lot of small variations, the other varies in lumps. Just like the income of the driver compared to that of bank employee, the two types of randomness are qualitatively distinct. Mediocristan has a lot of variations, not a single one of which is extreme. Extremistan has few variations, but those that take place are extreme. Another way to understand the difference. Your caloric intake is from mediocristan. If you add the calories you consume in a year, even without adjusting for your lies, not a single day will represent much of the total, say more than 0.5% of the total, 5,000 calories when you may consume 800,000 in a year. So the exception, the rare event, plays an inconsequential role in the aggregate and the long term. You cannot double your weight in a single day, not even a month, not possibly in a year, but you can double your net worth or lose half of it in a single moment. By comparison, if you take the sale of novels, more than half of sales and perhaps 90% of profits tends to come from the top 0.1%. So the exception, the 1 in 1,000 event, is dominant there. So financial matters and other economic matters tend to be from extremistan, just like history, which moves by discontinuities and jumps from one state to another. When randomness gets distributed across a large number of small units, along with small recurrent political disorder, we get the first type, the benign mediocristan. When randomness concentrates, we get the second type, the sneaky extremistan. Graphic 2 of your PDF file illustrates how anti-fragile systems are hurt when they are deprived of their natural variations, mostly thanks to naive intervention. Beyond municipal noise, the same logic applies to the child who, after spending time in a sterilized environment, is left out in the open. a system with dictated political stability from the top, the effects of price controls, the advantages of size for a corporation, etc. We switch from a system that produces steady but controllable volatility, mediocristan, closer to the statistical bell curve, from the benign family of the Gaussian or normal distribution, into one that is highly unpredictable and moves mostly by jumps, called fat tails. Fat tails, a synonym for extremistan, mean that remote events, those in what is called the tails, play a disproportionate role. One, the first graph in graphic 2, is volatile. It fluctuates but does not sink. The other, the second graph in graphic 2, sinks without significant fluctuations outside the episodes of turmoil. In the long run, the second system will be far more volatile, but volatility comes in lumps. When we constrain the first system, we tend to get the second outcome. Note also that in extremistan, predictability is very low. In the second, pseudo-smooth kind of randomness, mistakes appear to be rare, but they will be large, often devastating when they occur. Actually, an argument we develop in Book 4, anything locked into planning tends to fail precisely because of these attributes. It is quite a myth that planning helps corporations. In fact, we saw that the world is too random and unpredictable to base a policy on visibility of the future. What survives comes from the interplay of some fitness and environmental conditions. The Great Turkey Problem. Let me now move back from the technical jargon and graphs of fat tails and extremistan to colloquial Lebanese. In extremistan, one is prone to be fooled by the properties of the past and get the story exactly backwards. It is easy, looking at what is happening in the second graph of graphic 2, before the big jump down, to believe that the system is now safe, particularly when the system has made a progressive switch from the scary type of visibly volatile randomness it left to the apparently safe right. It looks like a drop in volatility, and it is not. A turkey is fed for 1,000 days by a butcher. Every day confirms to its staff of analysts that butchers love turkeys with increased statistical confidence. The butcher will keep feeding the turkey until a few days before Thanksgiving. Then comes the day when it is really not a very good idea to be a turkey. So, with the butcher surprising it, the turkey will have a revision of belief, right when its confidence in the statement that the butcher loves turkeys is maximal and it is very quiet and soothingly predictable in the life of the turkey. This example builds on an adaptation of a metaphor by Bertrand Russell. The key here is that such a surprise will be a black swan event, but just for the turkey, not for the butcher. We can also see from the turkey story the mother of all harmful mistakes. Mistaking absence of evidence of harm for evidence of absence, a mistake that we will see tends to prevail in intellectual circles and one that is grounded in the social sciences. So our mission in life becomes simply how not to be a turkey, or if possible, how to be a turkey in reverse, anti-fragile, that is. Not being a turkey starts with figuring out the difference between true and manufactured stability. Likewise, before the events known as the Arab Spring of 2011, we were duped by Egypt and Syria and are, as I am writing this, fooled by Saudi Arabia, about which a bit later. The reader can easily imagine what happens when constrained, volatility-choked systems explode. We have a fitting example: the removal of the Ba'ath Party with the abrupt toppling of Saddam Hussein and his regime in 2003 by the United States. More than 100,000 persons died, and 10 years later, the place is still a mess. 12,000 years. We started the discussion of the state with the example of Switzerland. Now let us go a little bit farther east. The northern Levant, roughly today's northern part of Syria and Lebanon, stayed perhaps the most prosperous province in the history of mankind over the long, very long stretch of time from the pre-pottery Neolithic until very modern history, the middle of the 20th century. That's 12,000 years compared to, say, England, which has been prosperous for about 500 years, or Scandinavia, now only prosperous for less than 300 years. Few areas on the planet have managed to thrive with so much continuity over any protracted stretch of time, what historians call longue durée. Other cities came and went, Aleppo, Emesa, today Homs, and Laodicea, Latakia, stayed relatively affluent. The northern Levant was since ancient times dominated by traders, largely owing to its position as a central spot on the Silk Road, and by agricultural lords, as the province supplied wheat to much of the Mediterranean world, particularly Rome. The area supplied a few Roman emperors, a few Catholic popes before the schisms, and more than 30 Greek-language writers and philosophers, which includes many of the heads of Plato's Academy, in addition to the ancestors of the American visionary and computer entrepreneur Steve Jobs, who brought us the Apple computer, on one of which I am recopying these lines, and the iPad tablet on which you may be reading them. We know of the autonomy of the province from the records during Roman days, as it was then managed by the local elites, a decentralized method of ruling through locals that the Ottoman retained. Cities minted their own coins. Then two events took place. First, after the Great War, one part of the northern Levant was integrated into the newly created nation of Syria, separated from its other section, now part of Lebanon. The entire area had been until then part of the Ottoman Empire, but functioned as somewhat autonomous regions. Ottomans, like the Romans before them, let local elites run the place so long as sufficient tax was paid, while they focused on their business of war. The Ottoman type of imperial peace, the Pax Ottomana, like its predecessor, the Pax Romana, was good for commerce. Contracts were enforced, and that is what governments are needed for the most. In the recent nostalgic book Levant, Philip Mansell documents how the cities of the Eastern Mediterranean operated as city-states, separated from the hinterland. Then, a few decades into the life of Syria, the modernist Ba'ath Party came to further enforce utopias. As soon as the Ba'athists centralized the place and enforced their status laws, Aleppo and Emesa went into instant decline. What the Ba'ath Party did in its modernization program was to remove the archaic mess of the souks and replace them with the crisp modernism of the office building. The effect was immediately visible. Overnight, the trading families moved to places such as New York and New Jersey for the Jews, California for the Armenians, and Beirut for the Christians. Beirut offered a commerce-friendly atmosphere, and Lebanon was a benign, smaller, disorganized state without any real central government. Lebanon was small enough to be a municipality on its own. It was smaller than a medium-sized metropolitan area. War, prison, or both. But while Lebanon had all the right qualities, the state was too loose, and by allowing the various Palestinian factions to own weapons, it caused an arms race between the communities while placidly watching the entire buildup. Disorganized is invigorating, but the Lebanese state was one step too disorganized. It would be like allowing each of the New York mafia bosses to have a larger army than the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Just imagine John Gotti with missiles. So in 1975, a raging civil war started in Lebanon. A sentence that still shocks me when I think about it was voiced by one of my grandfather's friends, a wealthy Aleppan merchant who fled the Ba'ath regime. When my grandfather asked his friend during the Lebanese war why he did not go back to Aleppo, his answer was categorical. "We people of Aleppo prefer war to prison." I thought he meant that they were going to put him in jail, but then I realized that by prison, he meant the loss of political and economic freedoms. Economic life, too, seems to prefer war to prison. Lebanon and northern Syria had very similar wealth per individual, what economists call gross domestic product, about a century ago, and had identical cultures, language, ethnicities, food, and even jokes. Everything was the same, except for the rule of the modernizing Ba'ath Party in Syria, compared to the totally benign state in Lebanon. In spite of a civil war that decimated the population, causing an acute brain drain and setting wealth back by several decades, in addition to every possible form of chaos that rocked the place, today Lebanon has a considerably higher standard of living, between 3 and 6 times the wealth of Syria. Nor did the point escape Machiavelli. Jean-Jacques Rousseau wrote, citing him, "It seemed," wrote Machiavelli, "that in the midst of murders and civil wars, our republic became stronger and its citizens infused with virtues. A little bit of agitation gives resources to souls, and what makes the species prosper isn't peace, but freedom." Pax Romana. The centralized nation-state is not exactly new in history. In fact, it existed in a nearly identical form in ancient Egypt. But this was an isolated event in history, and it did not survive there for long. The Egyptian high state started collapsing upon contact with the crazy, unruly, barbaric, disorganized, harassing invaders coming from Asia Minor with their assault chariots, literally a killer app. The dynasties of ancient Egypt did not run the place like an empire, but like an integrated state, which is markedly different. As we saw, it produces different types of variations. Nation-states rely on centralized bureaucracy, whereas empires, such as the Roman Empire and Ottoman dynasties, have relied on local elites, in fact allowing the city-states to prosper and conserve some effective autonomy. And what was great for peace, such autonomy was commercial, not military. In reality, the Ottomans did these vassals and suzerains a favor by preventing them from involvement in warfare. This took away militaristic temptations and helped them thrive. Regardless of how iniquitous the system seemed to be on the surface, it allowed locals to focus on commerce rather than war. It protected them from themselves. This is the argument brought by David Hume in his History of England in favor of small states as large states get tempted by warfare. Clearly, neither the Romans nor the Ottomans were allowing local autonomy out of love of freedom on the part of others. They just did it for convenience. A combination of empire for some affairs and semi-independent regions, left alone for their own business, provides more stability than the middle, the centralized nation-state with flags and discrete borders. But the states, even when centralized, as in Egypt or China, were, in practice, not too different from the Roman and Ottoman ones, except for the centralization of intellect with the scribes and the Mandarinate system establishing a monopoly of knowledge. Some of us may remember that there were days with no internet, no electronic monitoring of wire transfers to supervise tax receipts, and before modernity's communication networks, with the telegraph, the train, and later the telephone, states had to rely on messenger services. So a local provincial ruler was king for a large number of matters, even though he was not so nominally. Until recent history, the central state represented about 5% of the economy, compared to about 10 times that share in modern Europe. And further, governments were sufficiently distracted by war to leave economic affairs to businessmen. Note that people invoke an expression, Balkanization, about the mess created by fragmented states, as if fragmentation was a bad thing, and as if there was an alternative in the Balkans. But nobody uses Helvetization to describe its successes. War or no war? Let us take a look at Europe before the creations of the nation-states of Germany and Italy, marketed as reunification, as if these nations had been crisp units in some romantic past. There were, until the creation of these romantic entities, a fissiparous and amorphous mass of small statelings and city-states in constant tension, but shifting alliances. In most of their history, Genoa and Venice were competing for the eastern and southern Mediterranean, like two hookers battling for a sidewalk. And here is something comforting about statelings at war. Mediocrity cannot handle more than one enemy, so war here turns into an alliance there. Tension was always present somewhere, but without large consequences, like precipitation in the British Isles. Mild rain and no floods are vastly more manageable than the opposite. Long droughts followed by intense rainfall. In other words, Mediocristan. Then, of course, the contagious creation of nation-states in the late 19th century led to what we saw with the two world wars and their sequels, more than 60 million and possibly 80 million victims. The difference between war and no war became huge, with marked discontinuity. This is no different from a switch to winner-take-all effects in industry, the domination of rare events. A collection of statelings is similar to the restaurant business we discussed earlier, volatile, but you never have a generalized restaurant crisis, unlike, say, the banking business. Why? Because it is composed of a lot of independent and competing small units that do not individually threaten the system and make it jump from one state to another. Randomness is distributed rather than concentrated. Some people have fallen for the naive turkey-style belief that the world is getting safer and safer, and of course they naively attribute it to the holy state, though bottom-up Switzerland has about the lowest rate of violence of any place on the planet. It is exactly like saying that nuclear bombs are safer because they explode less often. The world is subjected to fewer and fewer acts of violence, while wars have the potential to be more criminal. We were very close to the mother of all catastrophes in the 1960s, when the United States was about to pull the nuclear trigger on the Soviet Union. Very close. When we look at risks in Extremistan, we don't look at evidence. Evidence comes too late. We look at potential damage. Never has the world been more prone to more damage. Never. A more rigorous reading of the data, with appropriate adjustment for the unseen, shows that a war that would decimate the planet would be completely consistent with the statistics and would not even be an outlier. As we will see, Ben Bernanke was similarly fooled with his great moderation, a turkey problem. One can be confused by the properties of any process with compressed volatility from the top. Some people, like Steve Pinker, misread the nature of the statistical process and hold such a thesis, similar to the Great Moderation, in finance. It is hard to explain to naive data-driven people that risk is in the future, not in the past. The messy multi-ethnic empire, the so-called Austro-Hungarian Empire, vanished after the Great War, along with its Ottoman neighbor and rival, and to a large extent, sibling. Don't tell them. To be replaced with crisp, clean nation-states. The Ottoman Empire, with its messy nationalities, or rather what was left of it, became the state of Turkey, modeled after Switzerland, with nobody noticing the inconsistency. Vienna became trapped in Austria, with whom it shared very little outside the formal language. Imagine moving New York City to central Texas and still calling it New York. Stefan Zweig, the Viennese Jewish novelist, then considered the most influential author in the world, expressed his pain in the poignant memoir The World of Yesterday. Vienna joined the league of multicultural cities such as Alexandria, Smyrna, Aleppo, Prague, Thessaloniki, Constantinople, now Istanbul, and Trieste, now squeezed into the Procrustean bed of the nation-state, with its citizens left in the grip of intergenerational nostalgia. Unable to handle the loss and integrate elsewhere, Zweig later committed suicide in Brazil. I first read his account as I was put in a similar situation of physical and cultural exile when my Levantine Christian world was shattered by the Lebanese War, and I wondered whether he might have stayed alive had he gone to New York instead. Chapter 6. Systems That Like Randomness explains the effect of overstabilizing organisms in complex systems, political, economic, etc. The defects of intellectualism, U.S. foreign policy, and pseudo-stabilization. Tell them I love some randomness. Maxwell and Extremistan. Complicated mechanisms to feed a donkey. Virgil said to do it, and do it now. The point of the previous chapter was that the risk properties of the first brother, the fragile bank employee, are vastly different from those of the second one, the comparatively anti-fragile artisan taxi driver. Likewise, the risk characteristic of a centralized system is different from that of a messy, municipally led confederation. The second type is stable in the long run because of some dose of volatility. A scientific argument showing how tight controls backfire and cause blow-ups was made by James Clerk Maxwell of electromagnetic theory fame. Governors are contraptions meant to control the speed of steam engines by compensating for abrupt variations. They aimed at stabilizing the engines, and they apparently did, but they paradoxically sometimes brought about capricious behavior and crashes. Light control works. Close control leads to overreaction, sometimes causing the machinery to break into pieces. In a famous paper, On Governors, published in 1867, Maxwell modeled the behavior and showed mathematically that tightly controlling the speed of engines leads to instability. It is remarkable how Maxwell's neat mathematical derivations and the dangers of tight control can be generalized across domains and help debunk pseudo-stabilization and hidden long-term fragility. The financier George Cooper has revived the argument in The Origin of Financial Crises. The argument is so crisp that an old trader friend, Peter Nielsen, has distributed it to every person he knows. In the markets, fixing prices, or equivalently, eliminating speculators, the so-called noise traders, and the moderate volatility that they bring, provide an illusion of stability, with periods of calm punctuated with large jumps. Because players are unused to volatility, the slightest price variation will then be attributed to insider information or to changes in the state of the system and will cause panics. When a currency never varies, a slight, very slight move makes people believe that the world is ending. Injecting some confusion stabilizes the system. Indeed, confusing people a little bit is beneficial. It is good for you and good for them. For an application of the point in daily life, imagine someone extremely punctual and predictable who comes home at exactly 6 o'clock every day for 15 years. You can use his arrival to set your watch. The fellow will cause his family anxiety if he is barely a few minutes late. Someone with a slightly more volatile, hence unpredictable, schedule, with, say, a half-hour variation, won't do so. Variations also act as purges. Small forest fires periodically cleanse the system of the most flammable material, so this does not have the opportunity to accumulate. Systematically preventing forest fires from taking place to be safe makes the big ones much worse. For similar reasons, stability is not good for the economy. Firms become very weak during long periods of steady prosperity devoid of setbacks, and hidden vulnerabilities accumulate silently under the surface. So delaying crises is not a very good idea. Likewise, absence of fluctuations in the market causes hidden risks to accumulate with impunity. The longer one goes without a market trauma, the worse the damage when commotion occurs. This adverse effect of stability is straightforward to model scientifically, but when I became a trader, I was told of a heuristic used by veterans and only old seasoned veterans. When a market reaches a new low, that is, drops to a level not seen in a long time, there is a lot of blood to come, with people rushing to the exit. Some people, unused to losing shekels, will be experiencing a large loss and will incur distress. If such a low market level has not been seen in years, say 2 years, it will be called a 2-year low and will cause more damage than a 1-year low. Tellingly, they call it a cleanup, getting the weak hands out of the way. A weak hand is clearly someone who is fragile but doesn't know it and is lulled by a false sense of security. When many such weak hands rush to the door, they collectively cause crashes. A volatile market doesn't let people go such a long time without a cleanup of risk, thereby preventing such market collapses. Fluctuat nec mergitur. Fluctuates or floats but does not sink, goes the Latin saying. Hungry donkeys. So far, we have argued that preventing randomness in an anti-fragile system is not always a good idea. Let us now look at the situation in which adding randomness has been a standard operating method, as the needed fuel for an anti-fragile system permanently hungry for it. A donkey, equally famished and thirsty, caught at an equal distance between food and water, would unavoidably die of hunger or thirst. But he can be saved thanks to a random nudge one way or the other. This metaphor is named Buridan's donkey, after the medieval philosopher Jean de Buridan, who, among other very complicated things, introduced the thought experiment. When some systems are stuck in a dangerous impasse, randomness and only randomness can unlock them and set them free. You can see here that absence of randomness equals guaranteed death. The idea of injecting random noise into a system to improve its functioning has been applied across fields. By a mechanism called stochastic resonance, adding random noise to the background makes you hear the sounds, say music, with more accuracy. We saw earlier that the psychological effect of overcompensation helps us get signals in the midst of noise. Here it is not psychological, but a physical property of the system. Weak SOS signals, too weak to get picked up by remote receptors, can become audible in the presence of background noise and random interference. By adding to the signal, random hiss allows it to rise sufficiently above the threshold of detection to become audible. Nothing in that situation does better than randomness, which comes for free. Consider the method of annealing in metallurgy, a technique used to make metal stronger and more homogeneous. It involves the heating and controlled cooling of a material to increase the size of the crystals and reduce their defects. Just as with Buridan's donkey, the heat causes the atoms to become unstuck from their initial positions and wander randomly through states of higher energy. The cooling gives them more chances of finding new, better configurations. As a child, I was exposed to a version of this annealing effect by watching my father, who is a man of habits, tap a wooden barometer every day upon coming home. He would gently strike the barometer, then get a reading for his homemade weather forecast. The stress on the barometer got the needle unstuck and allowed it to find its true equilibrium position. That's a local brand of anti-fragility. Inspired by the metallurgical technique, mathematicians use a method of computer simulation called simulated annealing to bring more general, optimal solutions to problems and situations, solutions that only randomness can deliver. Randomness works well in search, sometimes better than humans. Nathan Myhrvold brought to my attention a controversial 1975 paper published in Science showing that random drilling was superior to whatever search method was being employed at the time. And, ironically, the so-called chaotic systems, those experiencing a brand of variations called chaos, can be stabilized by adding randomness to them. I watched an eerie demonstration of the effects, presented by a doctoral student who first got balls to jump chaotically on a table in response to steady vibrations on the surface. These steady shocks made the balls jump in a jumbled and inelegant manner. Then, as by magic, he moved a switch and the jumps became orderly and smooth. The magic is that such change of regime, from chaos to order, did not take place by removing chaos, but by adding random, completely random but low-intensity shocks. I came out of the beautiful experiment with so much enthusiasm that I wanted to inform strangers on the street, I love randomness.